Okay, so my name is Ivan, and I'm going to speak about openness and programming with openness. So the idea of this presentation was born last year. In my job, I was asked to do some encryption using private and public keys. And I digged around and I found out that actually, although openness has been around for a long time, people have been using it from the command line, and the information about its API has been scattered around. So I decided that I need to talk about openness API. So we should start with some introductory words. First of all, is what's cryptography? We can define cryptography as a way to hide information, and cryptography studies the skills of converting some intelligible data into some unreadable data. So if there are eavesdroppers, they cannot find out the original data. What are the building blocks of such a scheme? So first of all, we must have a plain text. Then we must have an encryption algorithm. Then the encryption algorithms, they use keys in order to scramble the data. Then we must have a ciphertext. Then they produce ciphertext. And then the receiving party should have the decryption algorithm with which to find out the original data. So the secrecy of such system should not depend on the secrecy of the algorithm. So which means that the algorithm is widely known, but the secret part are actually the keys. So once we encrypt the data and once we send it, and of course it's eavesdropped by the enemy, what kind of attacks they can do on it? Well, first of all, we assume that the enemy have considerable amount of ciphertext. Well, if the channel is not eavesdropped, then we may not encrypt the data. So then the other type of attack is known plaintext. So which means that the enemy has captured some ciphertext, and they know what plaintext stands behind that ciphertext. And then we have chosen plaintext, which means that the enemy is able to encrypt some plaintext, some ciphertext, and he chooses the plaintext. And then the other one is the reverse. So the enemy is able to break some chosen ciphertext. And of course, finally, we have a brute force attack, which means that the enemy generates all the possible keys, and they try to break the plaintext with them. So also, let's define two notions of security of cryptographic systems. There is a notion of perfect secrecy, and it is also called information theoretically secure. Now, Shannon was the first one to give some definitions to those concepts. The notion of information theoretically secure, it means that no traces of the original plaintext are available in the ciphertext. The only thing that the ciphertext reveals is the length of the message. Or it may be put into other words, such schemes are considered unbreakable even if the enemy has unlimited computing power. Of course, in practice, this can be enforced very difficult. So the next notion is computationally secure. It can mean two things. The first one is the cost of breaking the system exceeds the gain, and the time required to break the system actually is larger than the lifetime of the information. One example of information in the theoretically secure scheme are one-time paths. Now, the one-time paths, they are simple to implement, but although the encryption and decryption algorithms are simple, they have they are difficult to implement in practice, mainly because of the key exchange. So we have an alphabet, and we have a plain text which is of length m. Now we generate the key of the same length, and we exchange the key with the receiving part. And after we exchange the keys, we encrypt the plain text to cipher text by simple XOR operation. Or if we have a natural alphabet, we add the key symbols to the plain text symbols, and these are the modulo, the length of the alphabet, and we receive the cipher text. Now the sending party destroys the key. After it destroys the key, it sends the cipher text. Then the receiving party receives the cipher text, and then it decrypts the cipher text to the plain text. I'm using the reverse, using XOR operation, or by simply subtracting the key from the cipher text. And then the receiving party destroys its copy of the key. Now, one requirement of the key is that it should consist of random data. And the first question is how we generate completely random data. It's not pseudo random. It should be completely random. No mathematical formula should stand behind the generation of the key. And the data which we use to generate the key should have highest possible entropy.
You speak into the microphone.
Okay. Now.
Oh, that's great.
Yes. The next thing is how we exchange the keys for the one-time paths. Now, if we want to send a message of a plain text of length m, we should have a key of length m, which means that the question of how we transfer the plain text is actually the question of how we transfer the key. In this case, the users of one-time paths, they generate a vast amount of key data. That vast amount of key data is either printed out in a booklet and transferred over a solved secure channel. When the sender sends the ciphertext, they specify the position of the key in the key data. Now, the question is how we destroy the key. If it's printed in a booklet, we can simply turn the page, burn it, scatter the ashes, and so on. Now, why this scheme is secure? This scheme is secure because if the enemy captures some ciphertext, and they decide to brute force it, and they don't have any other way except brute forcing, because the key is changed in every communication. They have to try all the keys. Then even when they try all the keys, some of the decryptions will produce eligible data, some will not produce the eligible data. But even for the eligible data, if they have two messages that are intelligible, that are in natural language, they cannot know for sure which one is originally sent. And after this overview of one-time paths, we will continue with OpenSSL. So OpenSSL is a library that, besides its SSL functionality, it provides a way for it's a library also for asymmetric, asymmetric encryption, hash computation, and message authentication codes computation. Now, it consists of several packages. One of them is it has support for multi-threading with mutexes. It has a package dedicated to error handling. It has a package for abstract input and output. This package is pretty rich, so once you create input or output objects, you write to them, and the implementation below can be a file, can be a socket, can be pretty much everything. Also for the for this input and output, it provides a way for several encodings like Base64, so, which means that you can send data to such a BIO, and it can get automatically encoded with Base64, for example. The next package is the pseudo-random number generation. Of course, we have arbitrary math, and which deals with big numbers, and we can generate big prime numbers. And of course, we have hardware acceleration with the engine package. The hardware acceleration package is dedicated for speeding up the cryptography, the crypto operations on hardware level. In fact, I did some quick testing on FreeBSD using circuits with Tenor, and it meets the needs. So next one is yes, pseudo random number generation. We need random numbers for a couple, for many crypto operations. And the generation of those numbers is provided by OpenSSL RAND package. These pseudo random numbers, their cryptographically strong, which means that they are not truly random, but they are hard to predict. We have to initialize the pseudo random number generator with a secret hand entropy. And so, how we see the random number generator? We have a couple of ways to see them. The first one is we can see them with a data buffer, and but we have to prepare the data buffer in advance. Next one is we can see them with a file which can include the def random file devices, and we can see the generator with another alternative entropy source. For example, the entropy gathering tool called AGD, which can be seen at agdsourceforge.net. On Windows, we can, as a last resort, we can see the random number generator with the contents of the screen or the mouse events, but this is only as a last resort. Okay, here are some examples on how we see the PLNG. The first snippet sees the PLNG from def-random. The second snippet sees the PLNG from def-u-random. And the last one sees it from the entropy gathering tool pools. The difference between def-random and def-u-random is, of course, that def-random is blocking. So, and def-u-random, it does not block. Of course, it's recommended for production applications to use def-random, because although def-u-random does not block, the entropy, the quality of the entropy may not be higher. Okay, so now we will speak about the symmetric encryption part. One key is used for encryption and the same key is used for decryption. There are two types of symmetric ciphers. The first one is the block cipher, and the second one is the string ciphers. The block ciphers split the data into blocks, and they operate on each block. The string ciphers, they operate on one plain text digit at a time, so they're like streams. And for the block ciphers, we may have to use padding. If the length of the data is not cannot be divided exactly by the length of the block. And the block ciphers are studied better than the stream ciphers.
Also, the Block Cipher malls, they operate in, the Block Cipher, they operate in different malls. We open self-support for malls. The first one is electronic codebook, the second one is Cipher blockchain, and then we have Cipher feedback and output feedback. Now, for the Cipher blockchain, in order to prevent dictionary attacks, each block after it is encrypted, it is XORed with the next plaintext block, and it provides it hides the structure of the plaintext additionally. Now we for the CFB and OLP, we may need to generate an initialization vector, and that's the vector that's XORed with the first block. Now, for how we obtain initialization vector and a key, our OpenSSL command line 2 can generate metric keys by when you supply some sort of passphrase, and from that passphrase it generates the initialization vector and the key. But we can also generate the symmetric key randomly. And I've provided one method to generate a random key and one method to generate the vector. So the method that generates the key simply generates some random bytes and stores them in the array for the key. And almost the same is done for the initialization vector. How we initialize symmetric ciphers, that's from the OpenSSL API. First we need to obtain a cipher context, then we need to generate the key and the initialization vector, and we declare the key, we declare the vector, we see the pseudo random number device, and we generate key and the vector. Once we have the key and the vector, we initialize the context with the key and the algorithm. The algorithm in this case is test with in CPC mode. And after we initialize the context, we are ready to encrypt or decrypt. Now, what is EVP? EVP package provides a unified interface for all symmetric encryption algorithms. As a matter of fact, EVP package provides a unified interface for asymmetric encryption as well as for message digest algorithms. EVP encrypted function, initializes the context with the desired algorithm, and the good thing of this API is that we can actually swap, in some cases we can swap the algorithms field. I'll show you an example of TESS, IS, and Blowfish encryption, and the code is almost one the same except EVP encrypt init code. Also, some options for some ciphers can be set in the EVP cipher context. For example, we can set the length of the key. We can also manipulate the options using EVP cipher context CKRL function, which is a more generic way, but it also has some limitations. For example, if I remember correctly, the options that are supported are for some stream ciphers. Okay, so once we have the context, how we do the encryption? We do the encryption by feeding the cipher with the available data to encrypt by calling the function name encrypt.data. And it accepts the context, the ciphertext. It has a pointer for the output length where we are going to store the length of the ciphertext. Then we pass the plain text and the length of the plain text. Once we pass the data which we need to encrypt, we finalize the cipher by the AMP encrypt final call, and we can pass there any leftovers of the cipher text. Now, panning is possible if the length of the data is not a multiple of the block size, then yes, OpenSSL provides panning.
Yeah, so you keep calling encrypt update as you get more plain text?
Yes. I will show you an example. You can feed the cipher with all the data which you have, but you can also feed it in parts. If the data is coming to you periodically, and you feed the cipher with what you have. And once you have everything, you can PNP final. Now the decryption works in a similar way. We use AMP decrypt update and AMP decrypt final. The parameters are almost the same. We provide the context. We provide a buffer where we are going to store the plain text. We provide a pointer for the length of the plain text. And we provide the cipher text and the input length. Okay, so let me show you some examples.
Can you see it or I have to increase the font?
Okay, how to increase the font in Emacs?
In what?
In Emacs.
In Emacs, how you increase the font? Options?
I don't have options.
Customize
based default. Oh,
there's a magnifier on that KDE. KMag.
Thank you. Now? Or more?
Is that good?
Okay. So first we declare the key, the initialize, the vector. We accept the plain text from the command line, and we see the PRNG. We take the plain text from the command line. We generate the random key, and we generate the vector. We initialize the cipher with this in CVC mode, and here we encrypt, I'll show you this function later, we encrypt the plain text into ciphertext. And once I get the ciphertext, I print it on the screen along with the key and the initialization vector. Well, printing the key on the screen is not the best idea, but for the sake of the example, I do it. So this function C encrypt, let me show you. That's the function to encrypt. Here I have a for loop, and in that for loop I continually call encrypt update, and I have an array where I store the results of the encryption, and finally I call encrypt final. And I return the ciphertext. So yes, you can continually call EVP encrypt update when you have data.
Better check that returns from now.
I'm sorry?
Better check that returns from now.
Yes, when I do the malloc call, I have to check if I have free memory, but sometimes I skip the check. Yes, you're right. And the function that decrypts is the same. I call every decrypt update, and at the end I call EVP decrypt final, and of course I have to check for malloc. Okay. Now, how we decrypt the ciphertext? This is another example. I received the key from the command line. I also received the vector from the command line, then I received the ciphertext from the command line. And once I got the key, the vector, and the ciphertext,
I called CD decrypt function, which is simply a wrapper around encrypted data and encrypted final. I dump the plain text on the screen.
Let me do a demo. So we pass some plain text.
On the screen we have the generated key, the initialization vector, and the ciphertext. Now with the counterpart program, we can decrypt the ciphertext. We get the plain text back. Yes. Also, I would like to comment on the fact that here in LP decrypt init and LP decrypt init. That's the only place where we actually refer to the specific cipher which we are using. In the example which for IS and the Blowfish, the only change is actually in the problem. So here we set up the cipher with AES with 128 bits, and the point is that this API provides a generic way to access all those ciphers, and you can swap it in within the code if you want.
Hey,
yes.
Doesn't the API provide like a factory function to get it by name?
Yes, the API provides a factory. The first question is: does the API provide a factory method to get the cipher by name? Yes, it provides, and it provides it. And I'll show you the factory methods for the message pages. So, but yes, it does.
Block size for the algorithms, do you select that, or is it a property of the algorithm?
Sorry?
Block sizes for the algorithm, for the...
Some algorithms, in most cases, the question is, can you choose the block sizes of the algorithms? I think you can do it for some of the algorithms. Not wrong. As if I remember correctly, this works with fixed block size.
Yeah. For the streams, but for the blockchain.
For the CDC mode.
I don't
But this works with fixed block size. But AES, you can change the block size. So when it says AC128, you can use 256. So I don't remember those details, but for some ciphers you can, for some ciphers you can't.
Going forward.
Now we are going to speak about caches or message digest. The best properties of the caches is that they take arbitrary one data and they produce a fixed size output. That fixed size output is called the message digest. They are one-way functions, which means that they are computationally difficult to reverse. However, there are some reports that MD5 can be reversed, and people advise that if you need to develop new applications, you should avoid MD5. Yes, also it's also computationally difficult to find conflicts, which means that it's hard to find two messages with the one and same digest. When people develop message digest algorithms, they pass them through some statistical requirements. For example, one of the statistical requirements is that one bit rate in original data should result in on average half of it should change half of the bits in the output. Usage of caches. One of the most popular things is password storage, where you combine the password with some salt, you generate the cache of the combination, and you store the cache, so you don't store the plaintext passwords. For digital signature, the digital signatures, they require asymmetric encryption, and the asymmetric encryption is slower than symmetric encryption. So what people do is they generate the caches of the data that's going to be signed, and they actually sign the cache data. Also, they're used for integrity checking. So how caches work with OpenSSL? They are similar to the symmetric ciphers. We get an EVP message digest context, and we initialize it with an algorithm. So we got EVP and the context. We got an algorithm, MD5 for example, and we can get the message digest algorithm by name with that method. So you can get a similar one for the symmetric ciphers. You initialize the context with the message digest. Then you do, you update it with the data that's going to be digested. And once you got the data, you finalize the digest. And another example.
There's also one call variance with the API.
Sir?
There is one call variance for like SHA hashes. You can just take a block of memory and produce a digester without going into.
Yes. So what Nikolai says is that you can.
You can hear you back.
Nikolai says that you have also just one function that does all this, which means that once you have the data in the memory, you can say just to generate the cache to detect the cache without doing EVP decrypt digest and EVP update digest and EVP final digest. Here's how we implement a digest. So we got the message digest algorithm, and we initialize the context, and we update the context, and we finalize it.
Okay.
So here I generated MD5 and SHA-1 digest by just calling my program and by passing the name of the algorithm which I want to use, and by the name of the algorithm, the message they just picked up, and the data is stages. Now, we are going to speak about asymmetric encryption, where one key is used for encryption, that's the public key, and another key is used for encryption, that's the private key. KPL generation, I'm going to discuss the RSA, I'm going to give an example with RSA. A key pair is encapsulated in an RSA structure, and the instance of that structure is created with the RSA generated key. We pass the number of the bits which we, the length of the key. We pass an extortion, and we pass a callback function. Once the key are generated, using the OpenSSL input-output API, we can easily store them in a pen format or linear format. So, here is an example of key pair generation. The first line here, the one generates a key with 2084 length. It uses RSA F4 for the exponent. And we provide status time as a callback function. Now, RSA keys, they are the same prime numbers. And the way you generate prime numbers with OpenSSL, you have the ability to provide callback function, and that callback function reports on the status of the prime number generation. In our case, it's a dependent function. If the callback function is called with code 0, it means that we have found the potential time. So the potential time has to pass through some checks in order to verify that it's a real time. If the code is 1, then this argument arg, that's the number of the tests through which the number of the tests through which the potential time is checked. And if we give the code is 2, then it means that we have it's a real time and we have found the time. The second parameter here, the API recommends that we use either 3 or we use 65,000 the fourth number of Fermat. So you use just two options, and those two options are in the API.
What's the purpose of that callback function?
The purpose of that callback function is the following. Since the prime number generation can be slow, it provides feedback on its status. So that when you generate
the progress bar?
Well, it's not the progress bar, you just dump a dot for each attempt. So when you generate an RSA key, you see from the command line, you see the, when you get dots. And well, that, those dots are, they come from code similar to this one.
Can you just give null to it instead of this function?
Yes, you can give null, but in this case you get null on the screen. I mean, if you don't want to monitor the progress, you don't want to. Now we are going to speak about RSA encryption and decryption in RSA. So we have two functions. One of them is RSA public encrypt, and the other one is RSA private decrypt. So we with asymmetric encryption, we encrypt the plain text with the public key and decrypt with the private key. Let me show you an example. Now we have some plain text, and we generate a key pair. We encrypt the plain text with the public key, and so we have to provide some padding. When you do encryption, you have to provide the padding. Once we get the encrypted text with the call to RSA private decrypt, we can decrypt it, and that's it. It's not that long. Of course, this example is a little bit trivial. I'm doing code this in one and the same program. Usually, the public key has to be exchanged with the peer, so that they encrypt the data and they send it back to you and you decrypt it with the private key. But in the core, in the end, you do RSA public encrypt or RSA private key. There is an EVP API that does this on higher level, and like, it's also possible to use it. So next thing is how you generate signatures and how you verify signatures with RSA. We can use two functions. One of them is RSA sign, and the other one is RSA verify. Here we provide the message request algorithm that's going to be used for the signature. As I said earlier, when you generate a signature, you actually digest the data, and you sign the digest because it's shorter. So you pass the message digest which you want to use. You pass the buffer which contains the data to be signed, and you pass the buffer for the signature, and you pass the RSA object. RSA verify it works similar. Here is an example of signing and verifying. We generate the pair once again. We sign the data which we have using SHA-1, and we do a call to RSA verify, and we check the result. If the result is non-zero, then the signature is we verify the signature, and if it is not, then the signature is bad. So that's pretty much my my presentation. I wanted to speak more about the asymmetric encryption, but unfortunately the examples for it turned out to be much more difficult. I wanted to give an example also of SSL, but it was going to be very long, and I skipped it. Yes?
About the padding.
Yes.
So I can see throwing the padding on. How do you know on the other end where your interesting text is ended and where the padding begins?
Yes, there is one type of padding which is called PKCS1. Now it works in the following way. If you have the final block, which is the block which you want to pad, and you have to pad it with 7 bytes, for example, or 6 bytes, or n number of bytes, you put the padding, you fill those bytes with 7 or 6 or n bytes. You understand? So by the other side looks at the final at the last byte of the ciphertext, it can deduce if there is a padding or not.
Is it null characters, or how is it?
No, it's not null character. If you have to fill 5 bytes of padding, you fill all those bytes with 5. You understand? Each byte is you put in each byte 5.
The value 5.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Padding can be tricky sometimes. I've been developing some problems, and they were constantly failing because of some padding issues until I adjusted the padding on both ends. So yes, it can be tricky. Any other questions? Yes.
When we were talking about creating caches.
Yes.
You mentioned salt.
I mentioned?
Salt.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on what salt is and how it works? Like how you, like...
Well, it's, again, the salt is some sort of random data, but it doesn't have to be secret. So you generate the salt and you keep it and you combine it. The point is that, let's say for passwords, even if someone stores your password database, it works the dictionary attacks.
So is it like an initialization factor?
Well, I wouldn't call it an initialization vector, because that vector is the thing which you extract to the first block of a symmetric cipher. But I mean, it's some data which you append to the password for which you need to store. Yes?
Just to reply to me, no,
I mean,
the salt, the source of the data for salt doesn't have to be secret, but it's hashed. So you're basically, if you do the same password, you know, 50 different users in an hour do the same password, you're going to get 50 different hashes. That's the idea of the salt. It's made unique by that whatever that salt content is. And the salt content could be unit time, it could be the exact time down in milliseconds, whatever it is, and then that hash, and however that's integrated into the, you know, the full hash for the password or for the encrypt data varies in terms of the algorithm, of course, but the idea is that it's just unique data at the moment, often time, in some form or another, that's thrown in so that if people have exact same values for encrypted data, it doesn't look like the same crypt.
If I could expound on that, salt was initially developed back in the old Unix script password days. Very early on, there was no salt on the password. So what ended up happening was people took a dictionary, they encrypted every entry in the dictionary, and then they just compared it to the encrypted password. And it's a one-way hash, but it doesn't really matter. So So they prepended it, or upended it, I think they prepended the salt to the password as plaintext, then hashed that salt plus password combination, and that made it much more computationally expensive to go, you can't just attack it with a predetermined dictionary now. You have to take every entry, look at its salt, and then add that salt to every entry in the dictionary, then encrypt it, then compare it, and it becomes much, much, much more computationally expensive.
You take away any uniqueness, I mean, you add uniqueness to hashing the same password values or encrypted text values. You know, the pearl is in the river, or the liver, whatever that thing was.
So, getting back to this, it sounds silly, but if you, how do you save, or do you need to save the salt to...
Yes, you need to save the salt.
So, how do you save the salt to a kind of secure method or not?
Yeah. You save it right there with your password, and your hash password.
Can you repeat that question?
How do you keep your salt secure, that's
basically... You can't, because if the salt were secure, you wouldn't be able to attach the salt to the plaintext and then compare your hashes.
Without the salt, you can go to Google and just put the hash right in.
Right.
And you'll see, you know, fuck you or whatever, decrypted right out. Like, if you MD5 without salt, fuck you, and put it into Google, you'll see that in the results list. But if you have it with the salt, no one has pre-computed that.
If you look at a password file, you'll actually see the salt next to the password. Forget the password.
Yeah.
It's right there in plain text.
No, it's not. The one that cash from salt.
It's a way to add like entropy to that for
now,
right?
Yep.
Or crypt.
You can think of it instead of one crypt machine, you have two different crypt machines. And it's like a selector between different crypt machines that you can start to change.
Sorry?
You can think of it as instead of one crypto gene, you have kind of two different crypto genes for your pathway. And you're selecting one of a range of different crypto genes based on the salt.
Any more questions?